call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this sunny and rainy March 20th. Open up a public hearing, first public hearing on Senate Bill 568, and ask our esteemed colleague from the other side of the building to come and talk to us about this. You got to bring him, huh? Gee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Monis Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale Village, and Fairview. And I'm very excited to, well, first of all, I won't be able to testify on House Bill 3162, which is the toxic disclosure later on. Just wanted you to know that I'm full support of that, and I think Representative Ken Geyer can take the lead on that one.
We'll hear enough folks.
Yeah, I'm sure you will. Anyway, Senate Bill 568, it is a product of great collaboration between the governor's team and the Oregon Health Leadership Council and the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and it is really essential or imperative that Oregon succeeds, as you know, in the implementation of our health care reform and transformation. We are the leading state, I think, cutting edge on health care reform, and there's really, it's not easy and it's very complicated, but we are a model for the nation and we have so much to prove. And there are two components to the bill, and I'm not going to go into each component other than saying the first part is a dispute resolution process to resolve disputes involving termination and extension or renewal of contracts. And then the second part is a two-year extension of our current policy on non-participating inpatient and outpatient hospital rate setting. With that, I will let the two colleagues on my right and left go into the particulars of the bill. It passed unanimously on the out of the committee, health care committee, and on the Senate floor, and I would urge the same. Thank you.
Enough said.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Colmer, Governor's Office. The good senator already said what we were going to be saying, and both Bruce and I are here to answer any questions you might have on the bill.
It's clear everybody who's been involved in this all along supports it in this. Yeah. And this is a part of a deal that relates to the bill we passed on the hospital self-assessment. These two pieces are pieces that the hospital wanted, as the hospitals wanted as a part. And you want to repeat what those two pieces are?
Sure. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. What this bill does is extend two pieces that are really bookends to the hospital assessment that have been in statute. It extends the par-non-par payment for participating and non-participating providers that was worked out over a series of years. It extends that as currently written through the life of the tax. And it also extends a dispute resolution process that has been in place in case healthcare entities and CCOs have disputes. It lays out an alternative dispute methodology whereby we move through a series of progressive ways to mediate disputes, and likewise have been in statute. And what this bill does is extend what's there.
Well, you just described the par non-par, please.
Excuse me?
The par non-par, would you just describe that a little bit?
Sure. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, the par non-par, if a CCO or managed care organization do not have a contract with a hospital, what the par non-par states is if you don't have a contract, you're non-participating, it sets a payment rate for that CCO to pay that hospital. And what it does is it creates a level playing field for negotiations between hospitals and CCOs that tries to create the right atmosphere so that they can negotiate rather than one trying to disadvantage the other.
Are there any questions on the panel?
Could I add just something to that? We did put on the record on the Senate side that the current reimbursement rate to the hospital will stay the same at 64% for non-participating hospitals and 68% for participating hospitals. And it, other than that, doesn't change anything that we're doing right now, and it just removes the sunset.
Representative Conager?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for any of the three of you. Actually, two related questions. One, is the dispute resolution process unchanged from the current dispute resolution process that was in Senate Bill 1580 that would apply to CCO formation periods? And second part of that question is, did anybody actually use it?
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Conger, members of the committee, the bill extends it to healthcare entities. It extends the same process, allows us to have that same process, not just simply for formation, but in terms of ongoing disputes.
Unchanged.
Other than that, the process itself has been unchanged, and the process is actually in rule, and that process has been unchanged. As for your second question, we've had several come close. We've helped to resolve some disputes, but I would say that we have yet to have entities that have formally gone down that road.
That's a good result. Okay, thanks.
Is there any other questions? Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 568 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 568.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 568 to
get out of here while you can.
With the due pass recommendation.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves Senate Bill 568 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Just call the roll, please.
Representative Klim?
Excuse.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Whitener?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Greenlee?
Aye. The motion passes and 568 goes to the floor. How about a carrier?
You want to do that? Good one.
I can do it. Yeah, mm-hmm. If you want.
Okay, Representative Conger?
Yes.
Representative Conger will be the carrier. We'll move up to the top of the agenda, and the plan for folks in the audience is to work down the agenda except for House Bill 3162, which will be last. I promise to hold 45 minutes for that if I can, but we're going to work on these other bills and move as many of them as we can. We have almost all the other bills with all the documents to move except 2240, is that right?
We have everything except 3458.
Everything but 3458. Where is that?
The first one.
Okay, well, let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3458. Hear what's going on with it, and then we will close it. And who do we have? Oh, Laura Colley? Yes. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Calley. I'm the Chief Actuary and the Manager of Product Regulation for the Insurance Division of DCBS. And we actually came to speak with you about 2 weeks ago before we had the bill in hand, gave an overview of the proposed state reinsurance program. So I won't go back into the details of that today. But did want to let you know where we stand with the bill, so now you should have the bill language in front of you. We have been working with industry and the business community on a couple of amendments, and we actually had a very productive meeting yesterday to get those moving, and we're expecting that we should be able to come back and discuss those amendments with you next week. And I'll just give a quick overview of some of the highlights of what those amendments will be. So just three of them that are that may be of particular importance. One is the definition of insurer as it relates to the assessment that funds the reinsurance program. The intent of that assessment base was to maintain the same assessment base that currently pays the OMIP assessment, so that that would be, you know, no different for the reinsurance program. So in particular, we're working on revising that definition, modifying it slightly to be sure that certain carriers, for example, vision only, accident only, specific disease, disability income, and hospital only, just to name a few, are not considered in that definition of insurer. So they're, you expect to see something that addresses that issue. There's also a clarification to ensure that the payment parameters that are set in the first and future years are consistent with the aggregate cap on funding that is set forth in the bill. So to, just to be very clear about what that limitation is, that there can't be, you know, there can't be further assessment and there won't be payments that exceed the amount of funding available. And another change that we expect to bring forward next week as well is a change in the board composition. Right now it includes, I believe it's an 11-member board as written in the bill. The amendment will make that a 12-member board, with two of those members being representatives of the business community. And those are pretty much the highlights of the amendments, and we'll look forward to coming back and speaking with you when we have those in hand.
And in 30 seconds, what does the bill do?
The bill, what the bill is doing is it is collecting, or it's taking an assessment base across the group and individual market to provide premium relief for the individual market. There's a federal program that already does some of that, and it's meant to address the initial rate increase that could occur due to uninsured, previously uninsured, and high-risk individuals entering the individual market. So this is an addition to that.
And it provides reinsurance for individuals whose expenses go over a certain point.
Yes, Chair Green, like it does provide payments for claims that exceed $30,000 per year, and it fits around the federal program.
And you're promising me everybody's going to come arm in arm and say it's a great bill, right?
I won't promise you exactly what everyone will say, but I think, you know, industry did speak a couple of weeks ago about the bill, and we will expect there'll be more discussion once the amendments are provided next week.
Great. Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3458. From now on, we have all work sessions until we get back to 3162. And we have the ability to move all of the next three bills, if it's the desire of the committee to do so, and I hope it is. Open a work session on House Bill 2859. Mr. Administrator, what do we got here? Who have we got coming?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2859 provides grievance process for medical assistance recipients, allows a party in contested case hearing to be represented by an attorney for a nonprofit legal services program, allows a claimant in contested case hearing to be represented by a relative, friend, or any other person of the claimant's choosing, defines medical assistance as separate from public assistance, conforms applicable statutes to reflect the definitional change, and allows both Oregon Health Authority and Department of Human Services to determine eligibility for medical assistance, aligns state law with the changes to federal Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program laws, specifies medical assistance application procedures for OHA and DHS, and the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange. The bill becomes operative January 1st, 2014, declares an emergency effective on its passage.
Bruce, why not? Will you join us, please? Do we need anybody from DHS, or you guys? You're authorized under the bill we passed to act for DHS in hearings, is that right?
I can answer questions.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, director of the Oregon Health Authority, and here to very briefly walk you through House Bill 2859 and some amendments to that. I think that Tyler did probably a better job than I did in being succinct and brief about what this bill does. I've been before you once before. We talked about it and walked through it section by section. In essence, this bill makes some technical and definitional fixes to clarify responsibilities for DHS and the Oregon Health Authority in determining eligibility for public and medical assistance. It makes changes in state statutes regarding medical assistance to conform with federal law that will take place January 1, 2014. And it allows Cover Oregon, our state's insurance exchange, to be included in the transfer of information and delegation of duties to assist in eligibility. I think, as you know, we're putting together a statewide information system that will allow individuals in one place to be able to go to a website, enter information, and determine eligibility for either the insurance exchange or for the Oregon Health Plan. And this allows Cover Oregon statutorily to transfer that information and help and assist in determining eligibility. That's in essence what this bill does. There are four amendments that we're fully supportive of. I'm going to let Judy Moore Peterson walk you through three of them really quickly, and I know that Rep. Conger has been involved in the Fourth Amendment, which we're also very supportive of, and I'm going to let him walk you through that, if that's okay.
There's very little new policy in this bill, right? This is basically to conform our state law with the ACA.
Yes, Chair Greenlake, yes, in essence, the new policy is one of the amendments allows out-of-state attorneys to represent people who have grievances. If you consider that new policy, then, and the one piece of new policy, which I think is an important piece of new policy, it's actually working towards policy, is the Dash 8 Amendment. That's Rep. Congress.
Okay. Judy, will you tell us what the three amendments do?
I would be happy to. Members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the Director of Medical Assistance Programs with the Oregon Health Authority. I'm going to walk you pretty quickly through the Dash 1s, the Dash 3s, and the Dash 5s. Those are the amendments that are in consideration. So the Dash 1s continue some cleanup of language. There was a definition of general assistance that had been deleted, and that was determined that it should be added back in. It's also removing the language around Eastern Oregon Training Center because it was no longer relevant. And then it was also making some corrections to align with federal law around how medical assistance can recoup dollars. So that's
we put general assistance back in, not because we're actually doing any right now, but because we might.
There's some definitions within the DHS side, within the aged and people's disabilities within DHS, which for which the general assistance definition does apply and is applicable.
Okay.
Right. Okay, so on to the Dash 3s. The Dash 3s essentially, in the cleanup process, when the separation of definitions was created between public assistance and medical assistance, what the process that they underwent was just to go through and insert medical assistance wherever they found public assistance. Well, in that process, it included medical assistance in places where it was no longer relevant. It wasn't relevant to be put there. So this is going and cleaning up the cleanup language to make sure that the definitions are appropriate to where they need to be. So that's pretty much the Dash 3s. And then the Dash 5s, that's Bruce outlined the fact that this adds that an attorney licensed to practice law in any state is an employee or contracts with a nonprofit legal services program, and in other words, an organization such as the Oregon Law Center, that they'd be able to represent somebody with medical assistance or public assistance in a contested case hearing. It also allows for
that they can be represented by a relative friend or any other person of the claimant's choosing. The other aspect of the dash fives is that it adds medical assistance for the timing of sending of notices. It is one of the aspects that was missed in the technical changes, in that these are the same timelines that we were held to before, and this just makes it so that medical assistance needs to send timelines or needs to send notices when there's been a change or a termination of services within a certain time frame. So that's it for that. So that's the dash ones, the dash threes, and the dash fives.
Representative Conger, will you talk about the dash eights, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Do you mind if I do it from here?
Say where you are.
So the dash eights mirror a bill that we actually had a hearing on early in the session, a bill that I introduced, and the House bill number escapes me now, but it fundamentally sets up a pilot program funding system for OHA to provide grants to CCOs to innovate specifically in the area of patient engagement in their own healthcare. The idea being, and during the hearing I was able to present some information about health outcomes and how important our behavior as individuals is in our healthcare outcomes. The slide that I showed, just to remind everybody, was 10% medical care and 40% individual decisions. One of the things that I thought was missing in our in House Bill 1580 in our healthcare transformation was this idea of trying to engage the patient and make sure that there were incentives and or penalties related to healthy behavior that would encourage people to internalize the cost of their care more, have more immediate incentives for longer term health, have financial reasons to seek out preventative care and things like that. So I think all of this, that's the first part of it. So the one issue I think I had with my bill was the funding source, and that has been taken out. Instead, the funding will come from OHA's, now I've lost the funding section, but it's not important. It's instead of coming from the tobacco settlement funds, the funding now would come from OHA's funding for CCO innovation, for healthcare innovation. And there's no specific amount. So it's really discretionary with OHA. It's providing a framework within which they can encourage, foster these pilot programs and accept applications from CCOs and try to start that process of innovation. And then the other part of the amendment is, again, very, I think, substantively identical to the bill that we discussed, and it's to appoint a task force on individual responsibility and health engagement to operate kind of alongside this effort to innovate within the CCOs and to look at what's going on and try to look at ways to scale that up and apply it more broadly. And my legislative aide, Andrea Hand, who is extraordinary, just texted me the bill number. And if I could get my phone to open, I would tell you, just as a, because she went to that effort, I think I should. And it was House Bill 2638. There, that cleared it all up. So that's the Dash 8 amendments.
And let me ask you a question, if I may. On line, page 1, line 15, section D, I'm assuming that means, I guess you and Bruce both, that there will be an evaluation process so we know what the project really did.
Yes.
That's going to be true of all your projects. You're going to have a sense that they actually did what they're trying to do.
Correct.
Or didn't do what they're trying to do.
Exactly. And hopefully that's an adequate description, but I know that Dr. Goldberg and OHA are on board with the idea of establishing metrics and measuring performance so that we can have good data to make decisions on.
Are there questions of any of the three panelists?
Actually, I do.
Yes.
Actually, this might be for Bruce or Representative Conger. It's going through because I have a bill basically kind of dealing with this to just seek a waiver to be able to implement the copays or engage, that will not be necessary if we pass this. Is that correct?
I'm not familiar with.
Well, you haven't seen it. He has.
Phil, Rep. Widener, but.
Vice second, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Rep. Widener. What this amendment would do would be to have this committee meet and bring forward legislation to that to the next session to apply for waivers, but it would really set out that planning process. So rather than applying now for a waiver, we would bring together a group as appointed in this amendment, have that group work on exactly what it is we would want waived and the kinds of patient responsibility we would want to establish in the state, and then we would go forth and seek those waivers.
So if we moved mine, it could help speed up the process.
Could we handle that as a part of a discussion of that bill? As we need it?
Yeah, because that's basically for driving behavior. So, but it's
it certainly wouldn't slow things down. That's for sure.
Okay. Other questions? Great. Thank you very much. Do we have some motions on this?
We do, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated 2/21/13. The -3 amendments dated 3/11/13, the -5 amendments dated 3/15/13, and the -8 amendments dated 3/18/13 to House Bill 2859.
It's called a grand slam.
Representative Thompson moves that we had the -1 amendments dated 2/21/13, the -3s dated 3/11/13, the -5s dated 3/15/13. -8 dated 3/18/13 to the right bill on this.
I think I'm done.
To House Bill 2859. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? House Bill 2859 is amended. We have another motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2859 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Thompson moves that we move House Bill 2859 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior referral. Okay. Is there any discussion? Could you please call the roll?
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Finnemer?
Aye.
Representative Wiley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Dyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Reed?
Aye.
Motion carries. House Bill 2859 as amended is on its way to Ways and Means. Godspeed. Yes. Have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules to let Representatives Klem and Widener vote on Senate Bill 568.
Just to remind you both, that bill came to us from the Senate. It was unanimous out of the committee and out of the Senate floor. It was the two pieces of legislation that were agreed to by the industry as a part of the self-assessment. And how do you vote? Do you want to ask them?
Representative Klim?
Aye.
And Representative Widener?
Aye.
Thank you,
Chair.
Thank you, guys. Open up a work session on House Bill 2091. Who's going to do that? Same two. Okay.
No, you can't get rid of us yet.
I'm sorry. Yes, please. He did a better job than you on that.
Always does.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2091 abolishes the private option health care for all Oregon children program. It allows coverage up to 300% of federal poverty guidelines of federal financial participation. It allows either the Department of Human Services or the Oregon Health Authority to enroll eligible children. It requires OHA to seek federal financial participation. It requires OHA to give written notice to responsible adults regarding end of private option and ensure orderly transfer of enrollees to another medical assistance program.
This does not have a subsequent referral?
Okay, we are adding one. We are adding one.
We are going to add a subsequent referral. Okay.
It says...
I'm sorry, what was it?
It does actually say subsequent referral to Ways and Means here.
Not on the agenda. That was just...
Okay.
2091?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mine has it. Maybe I get a special agenda.
Where do you see it? On the...
on the actual agenda. On the right-hand agenda. Corner underneath the notation.
That's no, that's the next bill.
That's for 22.
That's for the next one.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's good.
And we're going to take it off the next one?
No, it's going to...
They're all going to Ways and Means.
All going to Ways and Means. Okay. You want to add some comments on this? Anything you want to...
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee for the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. I think Tyler summarized the bill quite well, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. We went through this bill in some detail a couple of weeks ago when we were before you. This would be the Dash 2 amendments, 2091-2, which in essence ends the private health option administered by the Office of Private
it's
Health Partnerships.
Stuff, is that right?
Correct. And allows for the orderly transition of children between 2 and 300% of poverty from that program into the Oregon Health Plan and CCOs.
Are there any questions of this panel?
So, Mr. Chair, there's no fiscal or anything on this set.
There's a fiscal light on this since it's going to Ways and Means.
So.
Okay. Do we have a motion?
Yeah, close
the public hearing. Well, we're in a work session.
I'm sorry. I got lost.
Motion.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendment stated 315-13 to House Bill 2091.
Representative Thompson moves the Dash 2 amendment stated 315-13 to House Bill 2091. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Dash 2s are part of our 2091. A motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2091 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2091 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Kim?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative
aye.
Representative
aye.
Vice Chair
Guinea-Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair
Guinea-Geyer? Aye. Motion carries. 2091, to Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 2091. Open a work session on House Bill 2240. Is that Mr. Behrens this time? Is that right?
That's correct.
Oh, yeah, you. Please.
Well,
me too. Go for it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2240 aligns the Oregon Health Insurance Law with Patient Protection Affordable Care Act and establishes requirements for a health benefit plan. It abolishes the Office of Private Health Partnership and ends Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. It modifies health care for all Oregon children program to determine eligibility at 19 years of age. It allows the Department of Human Services Oregon Health Authority to specify eligibility requirements for private health option, different from requirements for other medical assistance. It allows purchase of insurance to the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange for private health option, prohibits child from qualifying for both private health option and other medical assistance programs. It abolishes the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool on June 30, 2015 and declares an emergency effective on its passage.
Thank you. Debbie, when you ask Senator Steiner Hayward to join us. We'll be ready for her. She's going to be joining us very soon. Okay, yes.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anthony Behrens. I'm a senior policy analyst with the State of Oregon Insurance Division, Department of Consumer Business Services. Lou Savage, the insurance commissioner, sends his apologies. He is welcoming, or just welcomed, a new granddaughter into the world. So he cannot be here today. I will just talk to you briefly about House Bill 2240 and the Dash 5 amendments. As you may recall, a couple of weeks ago, Commissioner Savage kind of walked you through a section by section of the bill. And just to remind you of the what the bill does, essentially it's a very long alignment of the insurance code with the Affordable Care Act. So it essentially ushers in or allows for the federal overlay of the Affordable Care Act, what we call the 2014 reforms. And we're taking the, we're suggesting the legislature take the same approach that it did in 2011 when it passed Senate Bill 89, which helped to allow implementation of the early Affordable Care Act reforms. So this bill has, we've worked closely with stakeholders, including industry, to kind of get this bill in shape, and we think with the Dash 5 amendments, it is in a really good spot. So we hope you'll take that into consideration. The bill touches on a number of provisions, and I won't or the amendments touch on a number of provisions that I won't go through every one, but I'm happy to answer any questions you have on other amendments that I don't talk about. But it touches on things as exciting as the definition of essential health benefits, and as my apologies to Laura Calley, as mundane as the filing of the actuarial certification. But some of the major points and topics that it addresses. Currently in the bill, we have a provision related to risk adjustment, and the Dash 5 amendments clarify that to allow for the state to kind of take a wait-and-see approach on risk adjustment. This is a federal program that essentially, it adjusts risks between insurers, so it looks at insurers that take high-risk enrollees and basically assesses them an amount and gives it to insurers. Excuse me, I had that backwards.
The other way.
Thank you.
Adjust premiums based on the risk, the underlying risk of the people that are covered by that premium.
Right. So it actually rewards carriers that take less healthy people or higher risk people at the expense of carriers that end up attracting the most
healthy. Actually, I'll take a subset. It doesn't reward them. It properly reimburses them, so that if they want to take higher risk people, they'll get more reimbursement. If they want to take, they may want to feature low risk population, it properly pays them for the risk of their.
Chair Greenlink, I apologize. It evens things out. That's a much better way to say it. This provision in the Dash 5s would allow the state, if it makes sense in a couple of years, to decide it may devote resources to running that risk adjustment program. As you just heard from Laura Calley, House Bill 3458 establishes the Oregon Reinsurance Program. Initially, that was supplemental reinsurance program. That was actually in this bill, 2240, initially. All of those provisions have been removed from 2240 and put in 3458. The provisions of abolishing the medical insurance pool are also put into 3458. One thing this bill does is it helps to it gives the division authority to require notices that insurers provide notices to consumers, And the idea there is to both streamline those notices so that there's not duplication, but that there's and to make sure that consumers receive all the notices that they should be getting, but to make them meaningful and readable at the same time. So the Dash 5 amendments do that as well. Additionally, the Dash 5 amendments remove a provision in the bill that's not in current law that would have established a rulemaking to look at implementing some network adequacy standards, and those provisions are being in the Dash 5s, those are being taken out of the bill. The idea behind that is that we want to take some time to actually look at what the market's going to look like after, you know, kind of the reset in 2014. So we think we need some actual time to look at standards that are in other states, standards that the NAIC recommends, and really to kind of analyze the market. Another kind of major amendment or change to the bill itself is removing the requirement that insurers offer a gold plan as a condition of licensure. This is not a provision of existing law, but this is a provision that was added by 2240, and the exchange will still have a gold plan requirement. You have to issue a gold plan in exchange. Outside the market, the idea is not to standardize the plan for inside and outside. So that provision is being removed. The bill also clarifies that portability coverage will terminate as of December 31st, 2013. The idea behind that is we'll have guaranteed issue in 2014 and lots of options for people. There are a number of other amendments, and I'm happy to talk about those or take questions or whatever the committee feels.
Everybody agrees to this one as well?
Everyone that I've talked to agrees with it.
I haven't heard any problem with it.
Yeah, I think it's in really good shape, Chair Greenlink, members of the committee.
Would you like to walk us through it page by page?
he can do that, and you can carry on the floor when it gets to the floor.
Page by page? Do I get that much time?
We waived that the first day. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
I have a motion on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 5 amendments dated 3-18-13.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2240 dated 3-18-13. Is there any discussion? Any objection? It is 2240. Motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2240 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves House Bill 2240 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
I'll be supporting it to go to Ways and Means, but obviously there are a few pages here. I haven't seen anything that jumps out at me, but it looks like there could be some very substantial savings in some of the stuff we're trying to do here. So,
and knowing how Ways and Means says that you may have to look at some more pages when it comes from Ways and Means. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative
Conger? Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative
Whiteley? Aye.
Representative Whitner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries, and House Bill 2240 is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you for the hard work you guys have all done keeping track of this one. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 3162, and ask Representative Kenny Geyer and my senator.
And Conger.
Oh, and Representative Conger, right. Bipartisan bicameral trio.
The usual three musketeers working together like this.
Go on, Harry. Something seems different.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Steiner Hayward. I'm the state senator representing District 17, which is ably represented by Chair Greenlick and Representative Parker as well. I'm going to let my colleagues do the vast majority of the talking, but I'm going to say two things about this very important bill. The first is that as a family physician, I'm all about prevention. And understanding what the effects that various chemicals have on people's bodies, it's really important that we get that information out there and do as much as we can to mitigate the impact, especially on our children. And children are, of course, much more vulnerable to exposure to toxic chemicals than adults are because their bodies are still developing and growing. The second is this is a consumer choice issue, and we expect in the medical world that people be allowed to make informed decisions about their care based on ample information and adequate, accurate information on both sides of the issue. Currently, parents are prevented from making informed decisions about products that their children are exposed to because of lack of information about these bills, about these their ingredients, and about what the risks are associated with some of the things that are commonly used in these products. And this bill would help educate parents, allow them to make informed decisions about protecting their children, and also to help reduce the impact of these chemicals on our children's bodies. And you'll get much more detailed information from my colleagues here at the dais and from other experts, but I just wanted to kick off. It's a real privilege to work with Representatives Conger and Kenny Geyer on this bill, among others.
Great. Thank you. For the record, I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer. I represent House District 46 in Portland, and I'm honored to be here today to introduce House Bill 3162, the Toxics Disclosure for Healthy Kids Act. Our committee spends an enormous amount of time transforming our health care system to improve coordinated care for Oregonians, with a special focus on better managing the care of the 20% of the population that use 80% of the that incur 80% of the costs, often due to chronic diseases. Oregon is also transforming our education system from birth to 20 to better coordinate support for children who are at risk due to health challenges, learning disabilities, ADD, autism, and other factors. Besides better coordinating our health, education, and human services, we also need to focus our attention on how to prevent the occurrence of chronic diseases and disorders wherever possible. Because of growing scientific evidence that demonstrates that some chemicals contribute to an epidemic of chronic diseases and disorders, House Bill 3162 will help the Oregon Health Authority track where the toxic exposure occurs in children's products, because of children's products. It will do so by, number one, designating a high priority chemicals of concern for children's health list. Two, publishing on Oregon Health Authority's website this list with information on potential health impacts of exposure. Three, requiring manufacturers who have an annual gross sales of over $5 million and who sell children's products in Oregon to disclose information about the high priority chemicals in those products. Four, requiring manufacturers to phase out the use of those chemicals in children's products and replacing it with a less harmful chemical as proven by a hazards assessment submitted by the manufacturer within 5 years of enactment of the law. Manufacturers who have not phased out the chemical from the product may apply for a waiver by submitting a hazard assessment that proves either the chemical of concern cannot be transmitted to the child or removing the chemical is not financially or technically feasible. The reason we chose the targeted children's products in the law and companies with this sales level is because these provisions align with Washington's law, which was passed in 2008 by a large bipartisan majority. I am delighted that the administrator of this program within the Washington Department of Ecology, Carol Craigie, is here today to answer questions about how that program works. We've had great cooperation with her as well as with Oregon Health Authority, the Public Health Department of Environmental Health. We also have two staff from them here who can answer questions. And I'm delighted that they have the opportunity to interact with Carol to learn how Washington has done it so we don't have to recreate the wheel and can learn from them about how they set up their database. Before I close, I want to draw attention to the enormous number of submissions. If you see on OLIS, there are 27 submissions. Three of those have to do with what's happening at EPA and TSCA. Three of those are in opposition. 20 of those are in support of this. Some of those include dozens, well, at least one of those include dozens of names. The OEC one, Oregon Environmental Council, details more information about the bill itself in lay terms. And I also want to draw attention to the one by Governor Roberts in support of this bill. Finally, I want to thank Representative Conger, Senator Boquist, and Senator Steiner Hayward, and so many others for supporting this bill. Thank you.
For the record, Jason Conger, representing House District 54, and very pleased to be here today testifying on this bill. Really appreciate the work that's been done on it. Especially by our colleague on the healthcare committee next to me, and wanted to give an illustration. It's too bad that the senator left, because she mentioned things that we come into contact with in the environment, and it occurred to me that here's a simple glass of water, and while we were sitting talking about this bill, I thought, well, I wonder if there's anything in here that I don't know about. I'm pretty sure there is. I remember my father-in-law, who was an engineer, telling me that water is a very powerful solvent. I didn't know that. It has solvent properties that stop quickly because it absorbs and then becomes neutral very quickly. But as a solvent, it could pull anything off of this cup that you can imagine. And I thought, you know, I don't know what the coating is on this cup. I don't know what's in the ink. I don't know what the cup itself is made for, although I think it's some kind of paper product, but with what binding it together, what's the glue? And then I thought, I wonder what's in the water already. You know, it came from that kind of bluish container over there. I have no idea what that's made of. And when you think about all of those things, I kind of have this confidence that whatever is in this cup, and whatever's in that water container over there, it's probably okay, because I assume that we are regulating at the state and federal level stuff like this in a way that makes it safe for me to use it. If I don't have that confidence, it's a problem. It's a problem for the water company. It's a problem for the cup seller. It's a problem for me, because I can't get water when I need it. So this bill is, I think, a piece of that picture, that sense of confidence that consumers have that we're looking out for their best interest. But I also think the cup point is to illustrate that our life is very complicated, and the products that we have around us in the environment, the products that we use, are very complex in terms of where they come from and what they're made of. I mean, this cup was probably made in a foreign country, which means that the ingredients in the cup were probably made in possibly another foreign country. I mean, who knows? Who knows where it came from and how far it's traveled or how it was made? Now, apply that in particular to children and the vulnerability of children, especially in terms of a developing physiology, and also a lack of knowledge about risk. And I became, through personal experience, I became more sensitive to that risk because, as some of you know, my daughter Madison, who's now a very happy, beautiful, and healthy 13-year-old, when she was an infant, before her first birthday, we lived in Massachusetts in an old house in a town called Hull. And part of the well baby visit for children in Massachusetts, because there's a lot of lead in the housing stock there in that state, is to go in and get a lead test on your blood. Hers came back extraordinarily high, and I was introduced to the world of the toxicology of lead and what it meant to the future of our baby. And it was shocking. It was frightening. Because the effects are permanent. It's not something you can cure once a child has been exposed. And so we were told for the rest of her life, she will have a lower IQ, she may have behavioral problems, she may develop physical ailments as a result of something that we had no idea existed in this house. And of course, we immediately got her out. We moved to a different house. The house had been painted, precautions had been taken, but the lead dust accumulated on the floor, and babies crawl, babies touch windowsills and things like that. And we were very, very fortunate that the reason her test came back so extraordinarily high for lead poisoning was because it was on the surface of her fingers. And the initial test is a finger blood draw. So later we had an IV blood draw and found out that she did not have lead poisoning. She had been exposed, and I'm very thankful that we were able to get her out of there. That made me aware of the fact that there's a lot of invisible things out there, possibly in this cup. I'm going to take that risk. But also elsewhere. Our chairman has the same confidence that I do.
You convinced me I needed a drink.
Her tolerance for risk.
So I think, you know, I had the good fortune of having it illustrated to me in a very personal way that I will never forget, that there are things out there as parents we can't protect our kids from because we can't see them and we don't know about them. And when you combine that with the physiology of children and the lack of risk knowledge in children, their behavior, sticking stuff in their mouth and crawling around and touching everything, and you combine that with the complexity of our supply chain in commercial products, including things like cups or sippy cups or teething rings and other things that little children come in contact with, there needs to be a high level of protection. And we need to have, I think, the state has a direct and significant interest in participating in that for the benefit of parents who also have no idea what's in the products that they're buying. So this is a great bill. A tremendous amount of work has gone into it, piggybacking on the really remarkable and kind of cutting-edge work that the state of Washington has done already that we can benefit from. I want to point out, because I think obviously you're going to hear some testimony against this bill, I want to acknowledge the validity of some of the criticism of the bill. This, to me, is not... Just as the supply chain to have a product arrive on our desk is complicated, so is regulating that supply chain, and so is identifying who should be responsible. There's also a lot of science that I frankly don't understand in how you determine whether something that's in this cup, A, is harmful, and B, can come out of the cup and go into your body. It's certainly above my pay grade, and those considerations, though, I think are very key for us to think about and to craft this bill in a way that gives credence to the science, but is also protective and informative and takes a step forward in protecting our most vulnerable citizens.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll hear a bunch of testimony. We have 12 people testifying in favor and 3 testifying opposed. I'll start with one panel in favor, and then we'll have the panel of opposition, and then we'll go on. We're going to give you 3 minutes each. It wouldn't hurt if you give up 20 or 30 seconds at the end of your 3 minutes and make sure we all get a chance to talk. And let me call, and we'll have the light on. When yellow comes on, it means 30 seconds left. Jason Graham Nye, Sarah Ditton, and Helen Anderson will be the first panel, if you'll join us now. And the second panel will be Matt Markey, Jennifer Sibbins, and Betsy Earle. Did we lose one? Jason Graham Nye, Sarah Ditton, and Helen Anderson. Okay, you guys go.
My name's Helen Anderson. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm also a mom of 3 little children, as you may have seen. One of the benefits of being a business owner is that I get to bring my kids everywhere with me. benefits sometime. I own a company called Milky's. We're a global company based in McMinnville, Oregon. We manufacture patented products for breastfeeding moms that are designed to safely collect and store breast milk. Milky's products are sold throughout Oregon nationwide, and we export to 35 countries. Milky's products are made right here in Hillsboro, Oregon. Milky's are also approved by the USDA and are provided by the federal program WIC. For clinics that support breastfeeding and their vulnerable population. As a registered nurse with a focus on lactation education, I designed Milky's to support families with information and products to help moms reach their breastfeeding goals, as we know is an important health topic. My products are trusted by mothers around the globe to be practical, user-friendly, and safe. Milky's cares about the safety of the materials that make up our products. Everything we make is free of chemicals of concern like BPA and phthalates. We've done rigorous testing to ensure zero chemical leaching. The impact of testing on our bottom line was very small. The testing was simple, required 3 product samples, and cost around $800. The test results never expire. This is a one-time cost. Our material is FDA approved. However, many countries require a higher safety standard. For example, in order to export to Europe, Argentina, and Japan, we needed to provide our distributors the lab results showing that our products did not contain BPA or other toxins. I also support House Bill 3162 because it will make a big difference to small businesses like ours that have invested in developing safer products and avoiding hazardous chemicals by requiring greater transparency in Oregon's marketplace and holding manufacturers responsible for phasing out hazardous chemicals in products for kids. This legislation will help other manufacturers to be good actors like Milky's.
Thank you very much. Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Jason Graham Nye. I'm the CEO and co-founder of G Diapers, a manufacturer of biodegradable, flushable baby diapers. We are a global company with a headquarters in Portland, Oregon. We moved to the US from Sydney, Australia to start the company, and we chose Oregon because we believed it's the best place to start a business that's committed to sustainability. Our products are now sold nationally and overseas. We sell in Target and Babies R Us as an example of two local retailers. As a manufacturer of children's products, that are for sale in Oregon, we're among the businesses that would be required to report and phase out chemicals of concern under this bill, and we fully support this bill. We support it because it will help to protect kids' health while also fostering innovation and development and the use of safer alternatives to chemicals of concern. Our own experience demonstrates how identifying chemicals of concern and finding safer alternatives can be done cost-effectively. Not only has this process helped G Diapers improve our products, but it's also having a positive impact on our supply chain. I'd like to share with you an experience that we had in terms of identifying these kinds of chemicals. When we moved here in 2005, we used cradle-to-cradle product certification as a way to look at all of the makeup of our product. It's the leading design protocol in design chemistry. We discovered the presence of a chemical that was regarded as red, which meant it would be harmful to the planet and or humans, and we were able to work with that supplier, and they were able to supply a safe chemical at same cost within 3 months, and that then has impact on their supply chain as they provide products to other manufacturers. Based on our experience, we know finding safer alternatives to chemicals of concern is feasible. Even growing businesses like ours can do it. As we can attest, the 5-year time frame for removing these hazardous chemicals is practical and reasonable for manufacturers. As a business owner who has seen the positive effects of identifying chemicals of concern and phasing them out of our products, we urge you to support House Bill 3162. Additional details are in my written testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can I call, if anybody has a question along the way, just let me know. Let's see. Matt Markey, Jennifer Sibbons, maybe, and Betsy Earls, please. Is it Sibbons?
Gibbons.
Okay. I thought it was Bibbons or Simmons. Both of them are wrong.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
I'll go first. Matt Marquis, representing the American Chemistry Council. I want to apologize first that you're stuck listening to me today. We were hopeful to have Tim Shestick with the American Chemistry Council here today, but his child was under the weather today, and he had to stay home. But briefly to the bill. So he did submit written testimony. You all should have with several handouts as well. They were submitted electronically. But first, I want to comment that I think we're under the. We share the same feelings that many of the sponsors do on this piece of legislation, and we want to say that we do feel that all products should be safe for children, and that's not our goal. Is not to create any product that is unsafe for children. That wouldn't be, you know, in our market practices. But I want to speak to briefly two points in the bill. First, it seems as though the bill makes an assumption that just because a chemical is in a product, that product is automatically harmful. And second, there are many issues that the bill tries to address, reporting, assessments of chemicals and regulation of chemicals that are also being addressed at the federal level, and we feel that there's some duplication in the process of how many of these chemicals are being regulated. The bill is drafted not only requires that you report these chemicals, the 19 that have been talked about so far today, but once a chemical has been on the list for 5 years, you need to replace that chemical in your products or seek a waiver. This is the opposite approach, it seems to us, than what the state of Washington does. Washington seems to go out of their way to say just because a chemical is in a product does not mean it is harmful. And on their website, they have several bullet points that they list on all of their reports of these products stating that that because a chemical is in a product does not necessarily mean it's harmful. Briefly, I'll talk about the federal level. There are over a dozen different federal regulations that regulate the chemical industry. One of the handouts that Tim Shestick supplied to you guys, it looks similar to this, goes through each of those different statutes, what they regulate, how they regulate it, with a brief summary on the other side of that. In February of this year, just this year, the U.S. EPA released information on 7,600 different chemicals. Chemical companies have been required to report to the federal government on chemicals for many years, but this year's report was a major expansion from the previous years. Again, I have a separate handout from Tim that you guys will have that goes into great detail, and I would encourage you guys to read this as to what is being required by the federal government on collecting reporting information from chemicals. And I will point to you that even on the second page of this document, it talks specifically about children's products. And so the federal government is now looking at how to report or requiring chemical children's products producers to report much of this information. And quickly, the EPA is also looking at 83 different chemicals that they have a work plan under that they are trying to reassess and collect more information on. And again, you have a large document from Tim, the TSCA work plan chemicals that they are continuing to assess on. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Gibbons?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair and members. I apologize. I'm sick right now, so I'm going to try to get through this as best I can without coughing. My name is Jennifer Gibbons. I represent the Toy Industry Association. We are a nonprofit trade association. We have about 600 members, both distributors, importers, and manufacturers of toys and other children's products. Our members are located throughout North America. We do share the sentiment of this bill, and we can appreciate that this committee has an interest in ensuring that toys are safe. For us, it is a year-round commitment, and we do support appropriate and strong children's safety and chemical regulations at the federal level. We do have many concerns with legislation like House Bill 3162, as these proposals don't often consider the existing robust safety requirements for toys sold in this country, and they create an unnecessary burden on companies doing business in Oregon with no measurable increase to safety. Safety is a number one priority for this industry, and I can tell you one of the sponsors of the bill previously mentioned, just supporting this legislation because he didn't know what was in products. All toys that are sold in the U.S. have to comply with numerous environmental and safety regulations that would make it illegal for us to sell toys or other children's products that contain substances that are known to be harmful for children and to which a child would be exposed. Those laws are in place. As Mr. Marquis mentioned, the Toxic Substances Control Act, TSCA, authorizes the US EPA to require manufacturers to submit information on new and existing chemicals, and then the agency uses that information to evaluate them for potential unreasonable risk, at which point the EPA has the authority to limit or prohibit the use of substances that are found to pose an unreasonable risk. And that is being done, particularly, you know, with toys. There are heavy metals and other chemicals that are known to cause risk and are regulated highly in toys. This bill, one of the big concerns with this bill is that there's no clear recognition of safety or exposure. The measure includes a mandate based on the mere presence of a chemical. Even Washington State has on their website that the data that they're providing should not be used to determine the safety of an individual product. And I think that that's a really important point to make because, you know, you want to have more information out there for people, but if the data you're providing them can't even be used to further determine the safety of a product, then, you know, it doesn't seem like this is the best route to go. Since my time is up, I will just respectfully urge you to oppose this measure.
I'll sort of give you another chance. Hey, one would infer from what you say that all toys show up here are safe because you follow whatever those regulations. I seem to remember one toy disaster after another over the last few years. I ended up with toys on the market that were completely unsafe for one reason or another.
I'm not sure exactly what situation you're referring to, but no matter where a toy is manufactured, it has to abide by all the same stringent regulations. And if there are bad actors out there, you know, that is an enforcement issue as opposed to a need for further regulation.
Thank you.
Chair?
Yeah, oh yeah.
May I weigh in at this point with a question? So, since you referenced my testimony, let me first of all make it clear that I didn't just say I don't know what's in that cup of water I was holding. I also don't know what chemicals or other components might be in a child's product, and neither do you. And I also don't know the science behind what products or substances at what level might cause harm to a child, or more specifically to an infant or a 3-year-old or a 12-year-old or an adult. I don't know those things. One thing you said was there's nothing harmful, I think, in products that are in the stream of commerce right now. And I think in saying so, you're suggesting that none of the products that we would list are harmful, which I find hard to believe because they include things like formaldehyde. I don't even know what this is, but it sounds harmful. Methylene chloride. I could go on. I'm pretty sure arsenic is in the list. You know, are you suggesting either that none of those products are, none of those chemicals are in children's products or used in the manufacture of children's products, or are you saying that those chemicals are not harmful to children?
You had several questions there, but I would like to just start by saying
I only had two.
Okay. I apologize, first of all, for paraphrasing your testimony. I should have done a better job at that. In the interest of time, I obviously didn't paraphrase it correctly. The substances that you mentioned, arsenic, formaldehyde, those are already regulated in toys, as are many other substances that have been found to be harmful. And, you know, for example, lead. Lead is you know, mandated there can't be any more lead in a toy than there would be in a rock. So I'm not suggesting that those substances aren't found in toys, but they are highly regulated. And I forget what your second question was. Did I not address both?
No, you didn't answer my question. There are 66 chemicals on the list of chemicals of high concern to children in the state of Washington at present. There are 19 of those chemicals that would be picked up by this bill as currently written. Of those 19, again, the question is, are you saying that none of them are in children's products or that none of them are harmful?
I don't know the entire list of 19 off the top of my head. I can tell you of all of the 66 chemicals in Washington State's program, the levels that at which they are, if the chemical is being found in a toy, the level at which you're finding that has not been found to be harmful, or there is no exposure route, because you have to have, you know, two things. The mere presence of a chemical in a product does not mean that it can cause harm to a child. And when the Washington Department of Ecology comes up here, you can, you know, ask them that as well, because even on their website, they have that the presence of a chemical in a children's product doesn't mean that it causes harm. So if those chemicals are in a product, which I can't tell you that every single one of them is or, you know, isn't off the top of my head, but if it is in the product, that doesn't necessarily mean it causes harm, because you have to then look at exposure, and then you have to then look at risk. And so these are all things that we are currently looking at. These are all things that toys are currently regulated for. Now,
I'm sorry, I got to stop you there, and, okay. And I'm going to relent, because otherwise I'll sit here and cross-examine you for about an hour, and that's not fair. However,
and we do need to move on.
And we do need to move on, because there are other panels. However, you just said something that is, I don't believe is accurate, and that's that every one of those 66 chemicals is regulated. You don't even know what's in the list, so I don't think you can say that, and I don't think it's true. I don't know every chemical that's in the list, however, so I won't say it categorically. And I am interested to hear whether or not there's any science, and I'll reserve this for the Washington Department of Ecology, that would suggest that any of those 66 chemicals are harmful or are in children's toys.
I will clarify. Chemicals
very
on that
briefly,
list of 66
please.
That have been found to be harmful in a child's product, to which a child could be exposed in the product, would be regulated. So if there's chemicals on there that have not been found to be harmful, then perhaps they're not regulated yet. I apologize that I haven't quite addressed all your questions, I think. So I'd be happy to follow up with you.
Let's move on. You can follow up directly with him then.
Sure. Mr. Chair,
yeah.
May I ask just one quick brief
sure.
question to see if I can help a little bit? Since you follow toys, I actually have some of the EPA stuff up here and everything. But putting that aside, right now, do consumers have a choice if they want to buy a bottle with BPA or BPA-free? Is there consumer choice for what chemicals they want in the products right now in the stores? That be option? Are those options being provided for them? I heard previous testimony saying that there are people out there providing those products to allow people the choice to buy chemical.
You're using an example of a children's food container, which is not the same as a toy, so I can't speak for that industry. I can't speak for that industry, I'm sorry.
So these are strictly toys that you wouldn't put in your mouth then, unless for some reason I wanted to chew on my roller skate?
Well, toys can be put in your mouth. I'm not trying to suggest that, but food and drink containers, because of their, you know, uses where they're being you know, reheated. They have different uses than a toy, and therefore they're in a different category than a toy, and therefore they're regulated differently than a toy.
We move on.
Yeah.
Thank you. Ms. Earls?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and also specifically today the Oregon Retail Council. AOI, to my knowledge, doesn't represent any toy manufacturers per se, but we do have a number of large national retailers who sell their own name brand toys and would therefore fall under the provisions related to manufacturers in House Bill 3162. And that is where our interest comes from in this bill. The safety of the children's products that our retailers sell is, of course, of the very highest concern, as it clearly is to the state of Oregon and the federal government, I think, as evidenced by the number of laws and regulations already applying to the regulation of toys. And we've talked about some of all of those today. And I would point out or bring up again that the state of Washington is also regulating toys and hazardous chemicals in toys in a way that's somewhat similar to the transparency goal that's contemplated by House Bill 3162. So while I agree that reporting on chemicals in toys is an extremely important goal, I would also submit to you that in a session where we're looking to make the most of every dollar that we have, and perhaps not spend money where we don't have to, it might be a good time to carefully consider the creation of an entire separate, independent, and brand new program in Oregon when a very similar one is in place in Washington. And that program is actually contemplated in our Bill 3162 in Section 73A, which would allow manufacturers to request their notices of toxic chemicals or notices of chemicals included in toys to be referred directly from the Washington program to the Oregon program. I think it's worth thinking about whether, if Washington already has a program that is so comprehensive that we can ask them to directly report to Oregon, if it's really worth setting up a separate program in Oregon at this time. If you do decide that that's the direction you want to go, I would respectfully ask that you think about including some disclaimers on the Oregon list, such as what Washington has, that make it clear that the mere presence of a chemical does not necessarily indicate that the toy is dangerous per se, but perhaps warrants further exploration. AOI agrees with the idea of transparency for parents and families, and our members strive to provide the safest products we can. But we are also, I think, as all of us looking to provide or seek the best value for our money, this session in all areas of the state budget.
Thank you. It sure might not be enough to prove that it's unsafe, but it sure be enough to get me not to buy it for my grandkids. Thank you very much. Next panel, Tony Fuentes, Lisa Frack, and Sherry Millstrom.
How are you all doing? My name is Tony Fuentes. I'm a parent as well as a retailer. My wife and I own Milagros Boutique in Portland, Oregon. We also do some small manufacturing within our boutique. I'm also currently the president of the Voice Business Alliance. I thank you for the opportunity to voice my support for House Bill 3162. At the end of the day, knowledge is power. And right now, the power of knowledge is lacking for families in Oregon on the presence of chemicals and products that they bring into their homes, and 3162 is designed to correct that. My support is based, of course, on my natural concerns as a parent. I'd like to know what's coming into my house, what may be put into my children's mouths, etc. But also as a retailer of baby products. When we started our business nearly 10 years ago, my wife and I were committed to keeping products on our shelves that are chemical-free and safe for families, that are sustainable and made ethically. Among other things, keeping BPA off our shelves is a choice that we made from day one. And just to kind of dovetail a little bit on the testimony you just heard, BPA happens to be a chemical that thus far the federal government has not actively regulated within the toy industry. And it's something where action, I believe, is very much needed on the state level. So I applaud you for moving forward on this. But in that particular instance, what I can tell you is that about 7 years ago, we started offering reusable sports bottles for kids in our store. We did a lot of research trying to find the most ethical manufacturer and the safest product and so forth. The bottles we selected were made by SIG. SIG's a well-known Swiss manufacturer that's been making metal water bottles for nearly a century when we started carrying them. They're based in Europe. Their product was made in Europe. When we asked them if their product were BPA-free, they said that there was no evidence of any BPA in their products, but that they couldn't actually tell us what their liners was made of because it was a trade secret. Knowing that they were seeing a lot of pressure from Chinese-made knockoffs, we accepted that, you know, all right, we'll take that. After a couple years of carrying the products, we started hearing rumors that there were BPA in the SIG products. We did went back to the manufacturer again, asked them again the same question, are your products BPA-free? They again stated there was no evidence of BPA in their products, and they provided lab reports and this and the other, but still refused to provide any kind of comprehensive list of chemicals within the product. About a year later, we received an email, as did all retailers in the U.S., saying that, hey, SIG bottles are now BPA-free. So, at that time, my wife and I kind of felt like, well, there ought to be a law. So 5 years later, we hope that that's what's going to happen, and I thank you for your leadership to help make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Greenlick, it's Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Frack, and I'm first here as a parent, and second, I'm here as the communications director for Family Forward Oregon. And we're a nonprofit based in Portland, and we mostly work family issues that relate to families. So we have most of our constituents are parents, and they talk about this a lot. Even though we focus on work-family issues, this comes up a ton. I'm really glad to be here today speaking in favor of 3162, because my oldest son is 10, my youngest is 7, and I've been focusing on keeping them safe, of course, since the day that they were born in 2003, or my son was born in 2003, and that was before BPA even came on the landscape. So I was one of those moms who had dutifully figured out how to, you know, nurse my kid at work and get the bottles and the pump working and find all the products, and then after it all was done, oh, and I even used hand-me-down bottles from my sister-in-law to be environmentally sound, and it turned out after all of that, you know, quite the symphony to get that done, that they had been packed with BPA, and there was nothing I could do about it. And I know those are feeding products. They're very different than toys, but having had two children, and all of you have likely had children or grandchildren in your life in some way, it's not just feeding products that goes in their mouths. I don't know if mine put more toys or feeding products in their mouths, but it's not just the toys, it's the everything's. It's your mattress, it's your paint, it's really a bit overwhelming. So what I find so great about this one is that it prioritizes for people and really says, we put the health officials on this, and we're telling you the real problems. So focus on those. Don't avoid everything, because we don't want to avoid everything. The manufacturers don't want us to avoid everything. We want to be smart. We don't want to spend all our time, like a lot of us have done for years, avoiding maybe stuff we don't need to avoid. So that's why I feel like this is really targeted, good approach. It helps the manufacturers with clarity about what's being focused on, what should we work on getting rid of, and it helps the parents with, oh, good, I don't have to worry about 600 chemicals, because there's, 85,000 on the market. We have to worry about 60. That's, freedom in a way, you know, from what we think we're dealing with. One quick response to someone who was up here earlier, I think it was from the toy manufacturer, is that there are a lot of laws, and there should be, because this stuff is dangerous, but they're not all working, and that's very clear with all these explosions of dangerous toys everywhere. But the TSCA law was passed in 1976, and it hasn't been reformed, and they haven't banned a single chemical, not even asbestos, with it. So they're not using it. They could be, but they're not. So I'd say the feds aren't doing it, and so this is a great place to be doing it. That's pretty much it. I would echo what Tony said. I mean, knowledge is power, and without it, the kids are suffering because the parents don't have the knowledge. So thanks.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3162. My name is Sherry Malmstrom. I've been a public health nurse specializing in maternal child health my entire career, and that's been over 28 years. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association in support of phasing out the use of priority chemicals in children's products. The Oregon Nurses Association is proud to represent over 13,000 Oregon nurses. Oregon nurses make up the largest segment of Oregon's healthcare workforce, and nearly every healthcare setting imaginable we're in, from large hospitals to small local clinics, from corrections to school-based health centers and community-based public health. The nurses that I work with in Multnomah County provide care to some of the most vulnerable residents. We take care of pregnant women, new mothers, infants, and children. Frequently, the people that we see have nowhere else to turn. They are struggling to make ends meet and to get by in this very difficult economy. They are likely to be in poor health, more likely to have children suffering from poor developmental outcomes, and less likely to know about the warnings around hazardous chemicals in children's products and toys. Frankly, they just don't have the knowledge or the time to track down the latest data on product safety. Many chemicals in children's products and toys can lead to serious health effects such as early puberty, heart disease, certain cancers, and reproductive disorders. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 133 million people in the United States, that's almost half of all of us Americans, are now living with a chronic disease or condition, which account for 70% of deaths and 75% of the U.S. healthcare costs. Reducing exposure to chemicals contributing to chronic disease will benefit the health of all Americans and the public, and as well as the healthcare system. As a matter of public health, the state should ensure that no Oregonian unknowingly purchases a product that contains hazardous chemicals for their child or their family. As a public health nurse, a mother, and a member of ONA, I support House Bill 3162. This is an important step toward reducing exposures to toxic chemicals and improving the health of all Oregonians. Long term, this bill will help ensure that parents have one less thing to worry about. And thank you for the opportunity for testifying today. I appreciate your time and consideration. I urge you to support House Bill 3162.
Thank you very much. I call the next panel, please. Andy Harris, Carol Krager, and Renee Hacken-Miller-Paradis. We'll have, after this, two more pro and one more opposition testimony, so move fast.
I'll go ahead since I was called first. I'm Dr. Andy Harris. I live in Portland. I work at OHSU, but I'm here representing the Oregon Center for Christian Voices, where I'm on the board. OCCV advocates for the poor and the needy, those who are most vulnerable and marginalized in our society. We are committed to economic and social justice and are a voice for those who are unable to speak, like children. So it seems inconceivable to me that manufacturers knowingly put toxic chemicals in products intended for children. The 19 chemicals listed in HB 3162 include arsenic, cadmium, mercury, benzene, and formaldehyde, among the most toxic of known chemicals. They need to be identified in children's products and subsequently removed for the health of our children. Because of time constraints, I'm just going to concentrate on one chemical, that's formaldehyde, which is contained in such products as Aveeno Baby Calming Comfort Bath, Breck Kids 2-in-1 Shampoo, Disney Princess Bubble Bath, and Johnson's Baby Shampoo. Of relevance is that Aveeno, Disney, Johnson, and other companies already have comparable baby products which use other less toxic preservatives not containing formaldehyde. Formaldehyde is classified as a human carcinogen by the World Health Organization and a probable human carcinogen by the EPA. Formaldehyde has been found to be genotoxic, that is, it can alter genes by changing chromosomes. Chronic exposure is exposed to sensitization that can lead to asthma attacks. So all the chemicals that are listed here in HB 3162 have significant toxicity for children. We just don't need them in these products. Oregon Center for Christian Voices urges you to consider the health and safety of our children first and to vote in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andy. Yes, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carol Craigie. I work on toxics policy, coordinating it for Department of Ecology in Washington State, and I'm directly responsible for implementing the Children's Safe Products Act that is referenced here. So I hope I'll be able to answer all your questions. Washington's Children's Safe Products Act was passed in 2008, and it did two things. It limited the amount of lead, cadmium, and phthalates that can be found in children's products sold in Washington. And just as a side note, that piece of the legislation was largely and substantially preempted by the passage of the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, not entirely, but substantially. But the other piece was not impacted by that preemption. And that is the reporting piece, in which Department of Ecology worked with our State Department of Health to identify chemicals of high concern for children, and then manufacturers who sold children's products into the state had to report on their use, a very similar set of characteristics. The statute does identify what the characteristics of chemicals of high concern are. They establish toxicity characteristics on the one hand and exposure characteristics on the other. And what we did in trying to identify what those chemicals are was built on the work of experts around the world, really. And we looked at authoritative sources that had looked at toxicity, for example, and they had reviewed the primary literature, all the scientific studies, and come up with a conclusion that the chemical met a certain criteria. It's neurotoxic, it's carcinogenic, it's mutagenic, etc. We did the same thing on the exposure side. We looked at authoritative sources, and we tried to come up with where's the evidence of exposure, not making any judgment about whether or not that exposure was enough to cause harm, but just that exposure was possible. And we looked at where chemicals have been found in children's products and where chemicals were actually in people, mostly from the CDC's biomonitoring work that they do across the nation. And just one little aside there, the governor did say, well, we're going to come up with about 50 chemicals. So that we had essentially a weeding out process to do. We ended up examining 3,700 chemicals on these two lists, and then they overlapped. And that overlap was our initial sort of sort. That was 476 chemicals. So we had to keep sorting. I have this nice long report that I've provided a link to, and I'll pass in, but it describes in nauseating detail how we did it. The end game was we came up with 66 chemicals. Every one of them is either in a children's product, in people already, we know from biomonitoring, is toxic, or is a persistent bioaccumulative and toxic chemical. I'm running out of time, so I will focus just on what we have done since then. We have promulgated our rule. Manufacturers have begun reporting. We have reports on, we phased in our reporting system to kind of take the burden off the smallest companies. And the largest manufacturers have reported on chemicals of high concern for baby products and now for clothing. And the next, we've had two rounds of reporting, and we'll have another report in August. And it'll take us a while to accumulate all of them. Most importantly, our law does not go as far as this bill does. 3162 would allow you to establish what are you going to do with the data. Our law doesn't do that. So it's a disclosure law. And what we intend to do is to use the information to identify products and functions, essentially, in the supply chain that could be should be targeted for alternatives, safer alternatives. So I'll stop there and...
Thank you so much.
Ask me questions.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
I'm afraid we don't have time for questions. We have five more witnesses.
Two quick ones, since we have somebody here who's implementing a program.
Pardon me?
Just two quick ones, since we have someone who's actually implemented the program.
All right. Very quickly, please.
Just real quick, two questions I have is, what does it cost the state of Washington to implement this? And the other one we're hearing, I mean, if people knew what formaldehyde, it's in almost every product that we use, formaldehyde is, every soap. I mean, I've done work in the plants. But does yours ban any chemicals? So the cost, and does it ban anything, what you're doing up there?
I will have to get you some specific information on the cost. That my recollection of the fiscal note at the time was it was about $300,000 a biennium, so that's... it's essentially one person I have, and I've supplemented with a lot of help from other folks. And then your second question was...
Is it banned?
We have no authority to do anything other than collect the information. I think it's this is an improvement over what we've got.
Thank you. Renee?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Renee Hackenmiller-Paradis, and I am testifying on behalf of the Oregon Environmental Council in support of HB 3162. I'm just going to highlight a few key pieces on HB 3162. There's many points in my submitted testimony, as well as a number of documents providing additional information, which I know you will all read. So we already heard what the bill does, establishes a list, asks for information about them, and then after 5 years requires an alternative assessment to be performed by manufacturers for products that still contain these chemicals to determine if there are chemicals that can be replaced for the harmful ones. We heard how the list was developed, and in your packet that I provided you, I give you the details on how the list was developed, and also information on the 19 chemicals that would be in our list, including their exposure and toxicity concerns. If you have any questions about those later, I'm available to talk about that.
I'm sure you're around the building.
I am a little bit, yep. For the second phase disclosure, as Carol shared, Washington's already implementing it. I think it's important to note that from this disclosure data, we can see these chemicals are being used in children's products, and providing this information is a manageable process for manufacturers. They're still selling toys in Washington, I believe. Thank God, because my children's grandparents live there. So, the intent of HB 3162 is to build on what Washington has done and use a process as similar to Washington as possible to streamline the reporting requirements for manufacturers. We heard that why should we reinvent the wheel and do it here if they're already doing it in Washington? We believe that we need to give OHA the authority to look at that information and do something with it, because it is going to cost some time. So we need that legislative directive for them to take that look. And then also, I want, contrary to what you'd heard, that manufacturers are not required to report on these chemicals, but they're not required to report on these chemicals in these products and at these levels. Now, they are required to report for some things, but not the levels that we're asking for. And I believe, I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure that this information is confidential when they do report at some of these levels. So, but I could be wrong about that. So, one difference from our bill, from HB 3162, is it exempts companies with annual sales of under $5 million. So we're not targeting the small manufacturers. And then for phase three, the goal is to remove these chemicals, the disclosure, the phase-out safe alternatives, to remove these chemicals of concern for children's products in order to reduce exposure to harmful chemicals that negatively impact children's health. And there is a waiver that companies can apply for if they don't phase out those chemicals, to if they can demonstrate that it's not technological or economically viable to phase out those chemicals. Or importantly, and I think this is an important point, we also put a piece in there that if they can demonstrate that the chemical in the products is not transmittable or doesn't end up in a child's body. I think the second piece is really important, because this is meant to address that we're only addressing those products where there is the potential to cause harm. So that second piece, I think, is really critical and addresses that exposure piece. HB 3162 provides an opportunity for Oregon to build on the work done by our neighbors to the north and begin to take meaningful steps to protect the health of our most vulnerable citizens. That concludes my comments. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Let me call John Hewitt, who's in opposition, and let me also call Susan Beal and Sandy Griffin for 1 minute each. I hate to ignore you since you've been here. Mr. Hewitt? Okay.
90 seconds each
time. I'm sorry, very briefly, yes.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Giffen, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Poison Center and Oregon Health and Science University in support of House Bill 3162, the Toxic Disclosure for Healthy Kids Act. We know that children learn about their environment through their senses, and this often results in exposures to toxic substances. Last year, the nurses and physicians at the Oregon Poison Center cared for over 18,000 children in Oregon who were exposed to potentially toxic or poison products. We have a great deal of knowledge about what happens when a child has an acute single exposure to a particular substance, but what is much more difficult is to identify the long-term health effects of chronic or multiple repeated exposures to toxic substances. The most frequent substances that children get into are products that are in their environment, and that environment is their home. Chemicals known to be carcinogens and hormone disruptors are found in air, dust, water, and infants and children are the most vulnerable population that can be harmed by that. Even as state agencies work to reduce toxic chemicals in our environment, the same toxics show up in consumer products, as we've heard talked about today, including products specifically marketed for children. These include formaldehyde, as mentioned, BPA, phthalates. This bill would take the important first step of establishing an efficient system to identify, collect, and share information about toxics as they exist in children's products marketed in Oregon. We have had numerous situations over the past several years of products that were identified to have very toxic substances that resulted in unfortunate symptoms of children, health effects that resulted ultimately in having them pulled by the market. So this would help us to prevent that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Greenlick and the committee, my name is Susan Beal. I'm very appreciative of this 90 seconds, so thank you for the time. I submitted written testimony earlier this week that I would be very honored to have you look over as well. I'm a mother of two young children. I live in Portland, and I am the product of a hospital in North Carolina where cigarette smoking was allowed anywhere that there wasn't an oxygen tank. And when I gave birth to my own two children at Providence, Portland, I'm happy to say that the only place you can smoke a cigarette is far from the entrance. I grew up in a house that may have had lead paint, and Representative Conger's story moved me so much as a parent. One of my daughter's closest friends went through a lead abatement after she was exposed at a young age, and it's a terrifying, even as just a friend, it's a terrifying experience. What I appreciate so much about this bill is that it takes the same common sense approach through a different method to regulating these toxic chemicals that our children are so vulnerable to, and as this most recent testimony speaks, I've called that poison line when my daughter ended up finding the bottle of vitamins and getting it open. And I really, really want to thank the committee and the sponsors for considering this legislation and moving it forward. What I also appreciate is, as a mother and a consumer, is that this rewards the companies that don't use these products. We all know that the market moves towards what consumers want, and the more we know, the more safely we can shop for our children. That means a lot to me. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a doctor. But my children mean everything to me, and the other thousands of children in Oregon are just as important as mine. Last, I'd just like to mention that my daughter's pediatrician and her specialist at OHSU all wholeheartedly support initiatives like these. Public health improvements like this don't come along every year, and I testified in favor of our attempt at regulating and banning bisphenol A the last 2 years. I really appreciate that this bill covers so many more chemicals. Thank you so much for the chance to testify. I greatly appreciate it.
I want to thank all who testified for your great discipline. We got through everything in an hour and 5 minutes. Very good. Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3162. We are adjourned.
Just one question. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to ask for maybe by email, and if you all would like to be copied, that's fine, some sort of flow chart from the manufacturer group about how, when a product is made overseas, it actually gets inspected. At what port, what agency, how much testing, what percentage of the products tested, so we know there's no switching in a factory in China. How do we know what it is?
Anybody still out there?
She's, yeah.
Good. Yeah. Copy us all.
For example, melamine. In